Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 9th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer. Today he will be continuing his series entitled, Is the Religious Right Wrong About Family Values? Today's session number is 9 and is titled, Parenting and Politics as if Children Matter. Let's listen in.
My name is Jack Nelson Pallmeyer, and this is the 5th in a series of 5 on looking at is the religious right wrong about family values and looking at what we would do differently as parents and as a society if we care about children. And what I'd like to do tonight is kind of offer some, they're not exactly summary comments, but they're comments that grow out of what has come before. And then have that be a basis for a pretty freewheeling conversation with each other. And I guess the starting point for me would be a couple of things. One, just to remind you that it's my perspective at least, that if we are to take the needs of children and families seriously, it really requires us to rethink and redo lots of things, both in terms of the personal choices we make, as well as the social, political, economic priorities. And I mentioned this in a previous session that I like to hold up symbols that I think are powerful or compelling. And two of the symbols for me that are powerful and compelling, illustrating that we really need to change course in terms of our vision and policies, is I've shared this before, that by the year 2050, if we continue as we are with the globalization of the economy, some very thoughtful people suggest that about half of the world's people will live in absolute poverty. Again, I have 3 young children. I tend to look at the world through their lens, and when I hear statistics like that or projections like that, I hope that the people who are saying that are dead wrong, but unfortunately I think they're probably right. And then it raises all kinds of questions for me about why did I bring children into the world, and or if that's true, then how are we to live? How are we to live differently? And the second kind of graphic, symbolic, powerful image of a need to change course is that the projections within our own country that if we continue putting people in jail at the rate that we are, and increasing the rate that we're putting in people in jail at the increased rate that we are, by 2050, half of the U.S. people will be in jail. Those are 2 pretty graphic illustrations of a need to look at our choices, it seems to me, in fundamentally different ways. Another lens that I've chosen for this morning to think about these issues is one I've only made reference to, but it seems to me that in the environmental crisis, we get some very good glimpses of why and what we might need to do differently. I would strongly recommend to you, I know some of you are seen carrying around this book, and one of the things you'll find in this book will be some references to different other different resources that you can turn to. And one of the organizations that I've learned to appreciate is a group called World Watch Institute. How many of you are familiar with World Watch?
Yes.
Okay, about half of you. It's an environmental organization, I would say, considered pretty mainstream, however you would judge that. And what they do is every year they put out a book called State of the World. And they look at how the world is doing through the lens of the environment. How well are we doing in 1996? And they look at land and water and soil erosion, and look at plant and animal diversity and what's happening to species and pollution, population growth, food production, all kinds of things that matter. And they published this report, I think, in 8 or 10 different languages. And I will just tell you, if you do read one of these reports, and I again strongly encourage you to take a look at them, for me, it is like, I don't know how to explain it, it's 2 things at one time. On the one hand, it's like pounding my head against a wall, which is very painful, because they don't mince words. I mean, they're telling us the truth. One of the things I talk about in this book is, for me, There is no hope without honesty. And I learned that lesson in a very personal way when my father started coughing up blood and went to a doctor, and the doctor said, you don't have cancer, you have chronic bronchitis. And we all went, oh, great. It was exactly what we wanted to hear. What we should have done is gotten several other opinions, because a year later, he died of cancer. Honesty is a prerequisite, it seems to me, for moving forward in a different direction. So that's kind of how I feel when I read these World Watch reports. It's like, oh, wow. On the other hand, they're very uplifting, because they tell us over and over again that we don't have to move in the direction of a world that by 2050 will have half of our people in jail and half of the people living in absolute poverty. That the problems we face are resolvable. That they don't depend upon technological miracles. So they're very hopeful, practical documents as well. And I've chosen this morning to provide a frame of reference that World Watch Institute has offered. And essentially what World Watch says, or said about 4 or 5 years ago now, the clock is ticking, is that we have about 40 years to make a transition to a sustainable world. 40 years to make a transition to living in ways that will not rob our children or our children's children of prospects for life. Now, I used to think 40 years was a really long time until I turned 45 years ago, right? And then it kind of puts it in perspective. Now, obviously, they're not hammering that date into stone, but they chose to share that date because they want us to realize that their fear is that if we proceed as we are, that in 40 years we will have irreversibly set in motion the destruction of basic life support systems on which we all depend, and all life depends. And they suggest that there are at least five fundamental things that will have to change if we're going to make this transition, if we're successfully going to move in the direction of sustainable societies, a world in which our children and our grandchildren and their children can live and have abundant life. We're going to have to do these five things. So I'm just going to name these and then have that be a frame of reference for us to think about the issues we've been wrestling with this week. The first, they say, is that we will have to end poverty. That the world will not survive, as we know it, divided between rich and poor. And that's true for lots of reasons. They stress that the rich, including those of us in this room, those of us who live in the industrial world, we do most of the environmental damage through the things that we produce, how we produce them, how we dispose of our waste, how we live. We have the resources to use and use and use and use. So we are doing the most environmental damage. But they also point out that the rich put the poor in a very difficult position. And so what we see all around the world is that poor people who have been pushed onto marginal lands, because 2% of the people own 80% of the land in about 75 countries, something like that, that they are destroying, the poor are forced to destroy their environments in their efforts to survive. So for lots of reasons, they are saying environmentally now, it is an imperative that we overcome poverty. The United Nations estimates that there are 358 billionaires. Think about that, 358 people. Multiply the number of people in this room, you know, by six or seven. And think about that, 358 people in our world today whose wealth, net worth, is greater than the entire incomes of half of humanity. That's how steep those divisions are. Now, given we're comparing net worth with income, yearly income, but it's still unbelievably shocking in terms of those divisions. I talk about in this book quite a bit what happened accelerating in the 1980s, and it's actually going faster now in the 1990s, is the redistribution of wealth upward in the United States. And one of the things that I would say is it's not only an environmental necessity now that we end poverty, it's a social necessity. Again, I live in an urban neighborhood, Minneapolis, And I know intuitively, practically, in everything that I see around me, that my children will not be safe as long as 55 or 60% of the children who live in Minneapolis live in poverty. My children will not get a good education as long as so many children arrive at that school with horrendous deficiencies that come out of poverty. Overcoming poverty has become a social necessity. In the 1980s, I was put a couple of these up, and again, I know some of you have this book, that you've either seen it or you can see it. In 1980, the upper 1% of U.S. income earners, their incomes were equal to the bottom 20% of income earners. So the upper 1% had incomes greater than the bottom 20%. By 1990, the one income of the 1% equaled the incomes of 40% of the U.S. working population. I mean, that's astounding, the speed at which we are transferring wealth upwards. One other thing that puts it in perspective, the income gains of this group, 1%, it's 2.5 million people. The income gains of that 1%, not their total incomes, their gains in the 1980s were greater than the total incomes of 50 million U.S. workers. So, World Watch says we will not survive environmentally divided between rich and poor. I would add to that that these divisions within our own society not only mean environmental breakdown, they mean the very breakdown of the fabric of our lives. And ultimately, as Brian and others have been teaching this week, our lives truly are interwoven together. And there's no safe place for us to hide environmentally. So overcoming poverty is one of the things that they stress. Second thing that World Watch says is we need to make a very quick shift to renewable energy resources, away from fossil fuels, away from nuclear power. And ironically, what World Watch says is one of our gravest dangers is that we're not going to run out of oil fast enough. And what they mean by that is, obviously, if we ran out tomorrow, the world would be in incredible crisis because of our dependency on fossil fuels. And they're not minimizing that. But what they're trying to point out is that our very use, and we're accelerating that use again of fossil fuels, are doing enormous damage to the life support systems, to the ozone layer, to the things that we need to breathe and to grow food and to live. So they say that transition is very important. And I would like to suggest that transition is important for another reason as well. When we look at a country that is attacking welfare recipients because we say that paying for the minimal amounts of money, the $12.9 billion the federal government offers for AFDC each year, is bankrupting the country, we're spending probably $70 or $80 billion a year in the Middle East on military maneuvers. And why do we do that? I don't think it's because we have a great affinity to people who live in the Middle East. We do it because of our appetite for oil. And again, I'll just make one last plug for this. I don't know if there are any copies left, but this is a book that I wrote in the context of the Gulf War. And the Gulf War, President Bush's popularity reached 91%, which I have found a fairly accurate measure in terms of classes I've taught and surveys I've given. And this book talks about a little bit about why we had a war in the Gulf and whose interests were served, and who wanted a military resolution to that conflict and those kinds of questions. But we need to understand there's a relationship between militarism and our insatiable desire for oil, for fossil fuels, and that the environmental implications of that are quite grave. I think, as a parent, one of the things that my children have a right to expect of me is to see Sarah and I working to try to ensure that they will have at least the basic environmental goods and resources available to them for a decent human life. And I can't guarantee to them that my efforts are going to resolve that crisis, but they need to see and understand that our family is going to take some steps and make some efforts to do that. Because I think if we don't do that, if they don't see that, some point of reckoning is going to come with our children when they are really going to be furious at us. And I remember going through that myself. Maybe all children do in relation to some issue with their family, but I was really mad at my mother and father, whose definition of the good life was just to keep me as safe as possible and to move to an all-white suburb, and they never told me anything about the world I lived in. They were trying to put me in a cocoon, and it took a long time for us to go through a healing process once I traveled and studied in Ethiopia and India and worked in inner city Chicago and did some things that opened up a different world that had been hidden from me. Okay, a third thing that World Watch says is that essentially we need to redefine the meaning of life. We need to move away from definitions of life that say we are what we have. We need to move in exactly the opposite direction of what every advertisement in this country tells us, that they can satisfy our deep needs. I read in one of the sessions a quote from Victor Lebeau, who was a retail analyst, who said, you know, we've got to make consumption our way of life. We've got to get people in this country to try to satisfy their spiritual longings and needs by purchasing things. Well, by and large, I think that's what we're attempting to do. And I can't think of people for whom it is more appropriate. Again, this wonderful translation from 1 Timothy 1, Jesus Christ came into the world to save those who have missed the point of living. That what we need to be wrestling with as families and as a society is, what is the point of living? And if you look at the psychological studies, some of which I cite in this book, Families Valued, you'll see over and over again, the psychologists tell us that the keys to happiness beyond a certain level of material fulfillment are almost all relational. They have to do with how happy we are with our spouses, how connected we are to our community and to other people, how fulfilled we are or decent we feel about our jobs. Those are the kind of things that give happiness. And one of the things that really troubles me is that young people now, when they're asked about being parents, in survey after survey, will say, parenting is going to be a very important thing for me. And then they go on to define what that means as not spending time with their children, but that they're going to be able to give their kids even more things, even more computers, more goods, more shoes, more. That if we think we can bombard our children with thousands of advertisements every week and not have it sink in, I think we're mistaken. So we need to have new definitions of meaning and move away from the present patterns of production and consumption. Another book I'll just call your attention to, I talk about it in this Families Valued book, is one of the few business people who has really taken this issue of the environment seriously is a man named Paul Hawken. And I would strongly recommend a book that he has written called The Ecology of Commerce. And as a business person, he was given he's a very successful business person apparently, I don't know exactly what he produces, but he was given an environmental award. And as he was going to pick up this reward, he realized that although he had done some, you know, his companies had done some pretty important things, that it was really a sham. Because he realized that recycling won't solve the problem. That what we really have to do, he says, is we have to learn to produce things in ways in which we produce no waste. He says, in nature there is no waste product. Everything is reused. And he's very concerned about all the toxic chemicals, all the the waste products that cannot be recycled into our world. So and then Hawken says that on the one hand, he's a very important voice, and he's getting at least some hearing within the business community, which I'm really pleased about. Another voice some of you may be familiar with is Wendell Berry, the farmer poet. And what Wendell Berry reminds us, he has this wonderful quote, which I'll share with you. He says, "However destructive may be the policies of government and the methods and products of the corporation, the root of the problem is always to be found in private life. It always leads straight to the question of how we live. The world is being destroyed, no doubt about it, by the greed of the rich and powerful," Berry says. "It is also being destroyed by popular demand." I think that's a pretty powerful balance that I've been trying to walk as I look at the crisis of families and children in our society between the personal responsibility and the social changes that are required. Fourth thing that World Watch says is that achieving sustainability will depend upon significant changes in our understanding and use and development of technology. Many of the problems that we've cited or talked about in the last week, they're accelerating at a more rapid pace here, but they're also, we're not the only country with them. There's a lot of the same problems that are emerging and deepening throughout the European countries and elsewhere. And part of the reason for that has to do with technological changes that are driving many of the changes in the global economy. Again, a wonderful book that I cite in here is a book by a man named David C. Corton called When Corporations Rule the World. And David Corton has an impeccable credential list, a trained economist, taught at Harvard, spent 25 years doing development work all over the world, and he's written this book called When Corporations Rule the World. And he talks about basically what is driving changes in the world today are the interests of about 1 million people. And that now it's the corporate interest which is defining the meaning of life. But essentially, in our culture and society, money has become the god. And chasing after money has become the god that in one way or another we are all beholden to and worship. And David C. Corton argues very, very persuasively, along with environmentalists, that we really are going to have to, in a sense, gear technology to other ends. We're going to need to create technologies and gear our research, for example, so that we can move towards towards renewable resources. We're going to need, in a world in which we have in our society already tremendous problems of underemployment, unemployment, low-wage jobs. There are books that are out now that are talking about how one of the reasons we're going to end up with so many people in absolute poverty is that so many people are just not necessary within the framework of a global economy for either production or consumption. So our technology is going to have to reflect certain values. Part of my trouble with limiting the family values debate in such a narrow way is that all of these issues reflect values. We're making value judgments when we produce a certain kind of technology and choose it over others. We're making value judgments when we decide to let a few people dominate a global marketplace and shape that in a certain way. Those all reflect values. And although we talk about family a lot, it's really the god of the marketplace which is dominating present public life. And again, to link this to last time's session, this becomes very important for me because it seems to me that lots of people in our society, again, are feeling insecure, and they have quite good reasons to feel insecure. But unless we begin groping with what's creating at a very macro level, but it's trickling down into every community in this country, is impacted by the present globalization of the economy under the kind of terms that that's happening. And it's tearing neighborhoods apart. It's ripping communities apart. And in that environment, racism thrives. In that environment, insecurities are easily translated into very mean places that I would rather not go. One of the right-wing evangelistic preachers named James Robeson who some of you may have heard or seen on TV, said a number of years ago at a training event for evangelical or for fundamentalist pastors on how to mobilize their constituencies for right-wing political causes, said, God is going to send us a tyrant to set things straight, to protect the godly from the ungodly, to protect the good from the bad. That's a very dangerous, when Anne's talking about can there be an us without them, it's one of the things that scares me very much about the religious right's take on a lot of these issues. There isn't much room for diversity. There isn't much room for democracy, at least as I understand it. Just two more to go, or one more to go. The fifth one is World Watch says, if we are to make the transition to sustainability, we will need new definitions of security. We will need new methods of conflict resolution. We will have to free up the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars that are squandered every year worldwide on weapons production. And we're going to have to, and this one touches everything from dealing with issues of men and violence, to raising children in our schools. You know, David, you mentioned you work with in your school, you have a pretty good program on conflict resolution. That's a very hopeful sign to me that that's happening in lots of schools around the country. But this whole notion, I don't know how long some of you have been here, I talked in the brief homily I gave the other night about redemptive violence, the belief that we teach our children very early on through cartoons that superior violence solves problems. It's a very dangerous message, it seems to me. By way of example, in 1993, the United States spent 22 times more for supposed military threats to our security than we did environmental ones. Now, there's a certain rationale of why that might make sense. But if we take seriously what we've talked about this morning in terms of the environment, it's very, very short-sighted indeed. Well, what does all this mean? Or where does this lead me then? And then we'll open it up for conversation. First, let me talk about social policy implications. And I'm just going to touch on a few things. First of all, it seems to me that we, as a society, would do much better in terms of helping families and children if, like other industrial countries, we actually had a family policy. We have a whole series. We've got some food stamps, we've got occasional, housing assistance, we've got AFDC, we've got, a few programs and all with their own bureaucracies that touch the lives of the poor, and basically have functioned, and I don't want to minimize how many people have been helped by welfare. Lots and lots of people have been helped by welfare, and that kind of gets lost in the present debate. But these programs were really never designed to help people get out of poverty. They were designed, in a sense, to help maintain people, not let them starve, but certainly not let them break out of cycles of poverty. And so I would, go ahead.
Just a point of information, I was in Appalachia last summer with a mission trip, and we had an evening where they presented information on how difficult it is for these people to get help. And they used the example that a single mother would have to have contact with 40 different agencies, one for fuel, one for 40, to get help. And they were talking about how the system really isn't effective for them.
It's a really good example. Whereas, and when we're talking about family policy, France is an interesting example. With the birth of every child, a family gets a family allowance, a cash allowance. Basically, an amount of money calculated so that it's very clear that that family will not be poor, will have adequate food, will have a place to live. In France, part of their family policy is they have daycare free available from age 3 on. I think in France it's even mandatory. I don't know if I think that's a good idea, but it is from what I can gather from reading at least, it's really a tremendous system, And one of the things it does is it kind of serves a need, only does it much better than what Head Start does, is that it really is an equalization factor. By providing children from age 3 up with really high quality daycare, it really narrows a gap that we find so prevalent in our own society between the children of privilege and those who aren't.
I was just going to build on your comment. One of the things, I just took an education course where there's been a lot of research done on Head Start. Many of the gains of Head Start are lost almost immediately, because when those children get into school, they don't get the kind of long-term support that they need, so, and they aren't going to get it at home because of the nature of parents trying to just survive. And so they find that at the point that they get to school, they've really caught up, and then all of a sudden they go the other direction, so that it kind of, you know, it does its job to a point, but
right.
We don't have anything.
But then we're throwing them back into an environment that we've been talking about. And that's what's interesting about a family policy in France, for me, is that you're giving families a basic income, not a huge amount of money, but an adequate income to meet basic needs, which a lot of families in our society don't have. You're giving them access to daycare. You're giving them, in many cases, access to training for various kinds of jobs. And universal health care is available. Now, you think about those, that's a pretty close to a fundamental list. If we were to do those things, we'd be doing, I think, much better by our children. Now, in the absence of that, which is kind of a lofty goal, there probably are some other things that we could do. I mean, I think we really need to continue pushing for a national health program in this country, similar to the Canadian system or another European example. We would do well to reinstate, it seems to me, progressive taxation in this country. I gave you an example that in 1965, income over $400,000 was taxed at a 91% rate. Between 1980 and 1985, it got reduced to 28%. And that's where a lot of this happened, was as a result of that. So progressive taxation, I don't know about you, but I get nauseated when, and I don't mean to signal these people out more than some corporate directors, but I think it's pretty telling in our society, the kind of salaries we pay corporate executives and the kind of salaries we pay athletes. You know, seven-year contract for $105 million for some center to throw a basketball through a hoop is pretty telling about what we value in the society. Now, if we had a 91% tax rate, I'd probably say, well, fine. That means we've got about $90 million to deal with that we can put into. So when we say things like, we can't afford national health insurance, we can't afford a family policy, I hope that in this class this week, we've given you lots of rebuttals to that kind of argument. Just another example, if we were to restore the corporate tax rate to its 1953 level, we would bring in $53 billion additional revenue each year. That would be enough to pay for food stamps, for welfare about two or three times over. And there's so many examples like that, where our taxation system really has put I think our social fabric in jeopardy. Another very important piece then is if we can't do it through a family policy, we have to do it in some ways, acknowledge the need for adequate childcare in this country. And you know, there are numbers of proposals. One kind of proposal would be to really offer parents the incentive to parent their own children in their home, but give them some kind of economic rewards or support in doing so. That's one option. Another option is to make daycare really available. And one advantage of that is, you know, we're part of a cooperative daycare system in where we live in Minneapolis. And it's, you know, we're really trying to pay living wages, but it's hard to do that. The daycare puts a huge squeeze on a lot of budgets, and it's very difficult to expect, again, driving the welfare debate we talked about yesterday, is this people are lazy and they don't want to work. Well, what are we going to do with the children? How are we going to adequately take care of them? So daycare becomes really important. Means test, oh, go ahead.
I just a comment. Yeah. I always think it's ironic that my one daughter who mows a lawn in about an hour and a half gets $25. My other daughter who babysits 6 or 7 hours to earn that same amount of money.
Interesting comparison, yeah. Another thing I think socially or society-wise we need to do is means test programs. I'll give you an example. There's two things. One is, think of all the money that we would have available in Social Security if we taxed all income.
Yes, I think that's a big one.
We'd have a huge pool of money, but we stop that so that the rich end up paying just a fraction and the rest of us pay, 7.8% or something like that, or I don't know what it is.
Jack, there's a book, Who Pays the Taxes, America, Who Pays?
Yes.
And today, a person who makes $50,000 with the rate of taxation today compared with what it would have been in 1950, that person would have to make $250,000 today. And that's covering all the hidden taxes that people aren't even aware of.
I cite that text in this book as well. It's a wonderful book called America. There's two books by the same writer. It's America, What Went Wrong? And America, Who Really Pays the Taxes? Both excellent, excellent books by two Philadelphia Inquirer reporters. I would also like to see if in our welfare reform, if we can't move to a family policy, that we would allow states a lot of flexibility to carry out their programs, but within the framework of federal standards. And the reason I say that is I live in Minnesota, which is reasonably progressive in terms of its approach to some of these problems. But the political debate in our state right now is that we can't do that, because as long as Mississippi is paying $10 a week, and Minnesota is trying to provide, you know, $600 or $700 a month, the argument is we're drawing all kinds of people to Minnesota. It plays states off against each other in a search for the lowest common denominator.
One of the problems that we have, and makes this confusing, is that we do have state governments and then we have a federal government, and we spend against, you know, like another country, and we consider only the federal, and we're not even considering the state. And a lot of our money, more than we even realize, goes out in taxes right now for the, like, the average people like you. Jack, did I miss it? Is there no concern about from World Watch about population?
Oh, absolutely, there is. And there, what they would say is that
it's
without
not a primary.
Well, it comes under their it comes up in a number of ways, but it comes particularly under their area of ending poverty. That the steps that you would take to end poverty have as a direct outcome the reduction of birth rates, because of what we talked about last night in the forum, that when you deal with issues of literacy, when you deal with issues of women empowerment, where you deal with issues of education and access to jobs, you're creating the conditions in which, I mean, and you also have to have a family planning component to that, but that is one of their issues, but they deal with it in a variety of ways, and I didn't mention it this morning, but it would come under several of those categories.
I bring it up again because I haven't heard it from one speaker this entire 2 weeks, and I'm appalled because I think it is the most important of all the issues. Why do we skirt it? Why is it the last thing brought up? Why?
Well, I think the reason that I didn't talk about it was because it's not ignoring it. It's just that, for example, I have the first book I ever wrote was a book called Hunger for Justice, and in that book I have a quote from the head of the U.S. Population Agency who says, we're developing the means to sterilize one-third of the world's women in order to maintain access to the world's resources. This is a quote from the head of the U.S. Population Agency. That so oftentimes that issue has been framed in a very, very, this is very unfortunate because there is a real need for family planning programs. And again, this would also come up under World Watch's thing about redefining security. They would say preventing 4 billion unwanted pregnancies, which we can do by empowering women at a cost of about $25 billion a year, that we should be doing that rather than spending, you know, $700 or $800 billion or $900 billion a year worldwide on military expenditure. So they do bring it up, but they would bring it up in those kind of contexts.
Well, okay. I do want to make the point that I'm hoping it will get brought up as a primary thing in these talks from now on, because it's like, it seems to me that partly why we don't is because it's a religious thing, or you know, we have our own three children or our own five children, and it's like, well, I got out. But, you know, maybe we realize it after we've already done that or something, but it's like somewhere we have to bring this up and really make it an issue that is talked about in these forums. And I don't mean to belabor it, it's just that if it weren't so missing, I wouldn't need to.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, let me just bring this to a close by touching on a few of the personal changes, and this will be very quick, but I think it's pretty clear that our children need adequate time with us. And that a lot of children aren't getting the time that they need with parents. Carnegie Foundation did a study that says that half of U.S. children are at serious risk of really damaging their life chances permanently from things like drugs, early sexual activity, a whole bunch of things. And they link a lot of that to the fact that both poor children, the children of the poor and the children of the rich, don't really have much interaction with their children. Either because we're pursuing affluence or because we're pursuing survival or some of the choices we make. And I'm the first to acknowledge that there's a lot of people in our society who don't have many choices about time. But some of us do. And I think to take children's needs seriously really means assessing that balance between time. A lot of us, I know my parents, their view really was, and they're wonderful people, was we want to provide a good life for our children, a better life than we had. How many of you ever heard that? You know, we're going to provide a better life for our kids. But in the 50s and 60s, that definition of what that meant really did center around having more and more and more things. And how that translated into relational time with my parents really wasn't much. And I think that's a real huge thing.
Jack, how do you define adequate?
Adequate time?
How do you define that?
Well, I think probably all of us have to define that for ourselves. But I would say, you know, that if possible, it's a good idea if you have two parents around not to have both of them working full time. You know, the choices that Sarah and I make are both to work less than half time and to, in large measure, co-parent so that the children are getting time with dad, time with mom.
Less than full time.
Less than full time, right. Less than full time. What did I say?
Less than half.
Oh, sorry. Now, I wish that were true, but that's less than full time. And, you know, there's just all kinds of ways of seeing it. When I look at how we parent relative to how others in my family parent, I see Sarah and I choose to limit our income. And so we kind of set an income goal that we need as a family. But we have, you know, family members in our immediate families who make 2, 3, 5, 6 times, 7 times more money than we make. But I don't think, in at least some of those cases, that their families are nearly as healthy as our family is because of relational issues. Another thing would be, in our society, the temptation is to do so many things. I think the temptation of the affluent is you know, we're just racing from, you know, the skating lesson to the piano lesson to the poetry reading to the, you know, whatever it is, to the museum. It may all be good, really good stuff, but it adds up to too much. You know, how many meals do we sit around and actually eat together as families? All those become ways of measuring whether it's adequate or not.
I think another point of departure for the time is the extended family. I grew up next to one set of grandparents, so and I did have only one parent working, but I was parented quite a bit by my grandparents and my parents. And now most families don't have that because we move around so much. Grandparents could be on the other side of the country or something. And so I think there's more pressure on the nuclear family than there ever has been before because the extended family just isn't there anymore.
That's a really, really good point. And part of another one of the things I haven't mentioned is, I think to extend that even out further is the sense of community. I think when, and I don't want to idealize the past, but the neighborhood that I grew up in, that my parents moved out of so we could be in a nice, safe suburb, was really much more of a community. Small houses, no fences, in and out of each other's homes, We were watching out for George and Beth, and they were watching out for Jack and Jim. You know, there was a sense of in which children in this neighborhood were children of the neighborhood. That has broken down too. And you know, Sarah and I, who are part of this alternative community called the Community of St. Martin, one of the things that community, people in the community have done, is there's probably, how many, 25 or so people maybe, and children who live within a mile of each other.
25 households.
25 households that live within a mile of each other. Well, it's amazing the things that you can do there that's different even from the church that we belong to that's a mile away. Because our neighbors are across the street and their children are in our homes, and everywhere you go, whether it's to the grocery store or to the park, you are interacting with people in meaningful ways. I think in our society, what we've discovered is to have that, you have to make conscious choices to create it, because otherwise, as you say, it's just breaking down. Yeah. Someone else had a, yeah.
Yeah, I have two comments. One is what really strikes me, we chose on living on one income, which meant that, well, we were able after 8 years to buy our first home. But so we rented out, and never, at least I was able to stay home with the kids. What I find myself, I call it, maybe it's the parent trap, there is so much pressure on you when you look at what other parents are doing with the kids and how they are, the way you just described it, shuffling from one place to the other, that you end up really circling and just really, in the literal sense of the word, you lose your priorities and you're just racing. I hear comments in the schools that, well, the kids are not challenged enough, or the above average kids are not being challenged enough, we need more enrichment programs, which to a certain extent is nice, but I started realizing that a lot of these enrichment programs that parents are asking for actually should be happening at home, which is the way I saw it at home.
Yes. Thank you from the teachers in the classroom.
That really strikes me. You have some really critical parents at the school. We need more enrichment, And often you just need to sit down or just walk down to the stream with your kid and just enjoy nature or point at something or sit down with a book. Another point I wanted, as you just described neighborhoods, I'm involved a little bit in my community, and I recently volunteered for 10 months in a group of citizens in our county that had the task of coming up with some long-term visions for our transportation problems. And one of the recommendations we made is that we need to finish up, we need to pay a lot of attention to the way we are designing our neighborhoods. Among other things, steering away also from fossil fuels and paying more attention to sidewalks, retrofit. A lot of neighborhoods that in the 50s, 60s, they built them without sidewalks. And if you build sidewalks, people will walk more, you stop, you talk to people, and this way you also create a little.
Yeah.
It's a start in a friendly community.
Good, very, very helpful comment. Yeah.
One thing I've noticed, the front porch disappeared. That was where people went down.
The front porch, in New York, right?
It's amazing. Almost every night. Well, we live in Minnesota, so this does not take place in the winter. But every night, weather permitting, you will find, you know, that we're around. We'll find Sarah and I, or one of us, out in front, and usually the kids. And it's just a magnet. You know, people come out, and I think about that a lot, that people's, you know, fenced-in back walls are really walling us off from community. And I find that to be so interesting because on one level, I sense a deep longing for community when I'm out there and I'm talking to people. They might not exactly use that word. But on the other hand, and Sarah and I were talking about this, so many of the personal choices that we make, so many of our needs for privacy and space and all those things get translated into building things like backyard fences and walls and porches, where we cut ourselves off from the possibility of community. It's a real contradiction that I think we need to wrestle with. Yeah.
Did you
finish up on the comments that you're making?
Well, I had one or two more, but this is great. This is better than my comments, so let's keep going.
There were two issues that I wanted to mention. One, the lack of time that families have, the need for both parents to be working. For the most part, from what I've observed from my friends and coworkers and whatnot, is the need for the bigger house, the biggest possible house in the neighborhoods. And so that's where most of the income goes. And so the fact that we're willing to float this, basically a speculative venture in a lot of cases, we're hoping we're going to make money because we bought the right house in the right neighborhood, we subsidize this effort. That's the big rat race that you get caught up in. And it hits home very deeply to a lot of people, because the last thing you want to do is mess with people's houses. We'll talk about it.
Well, it's again the possession thing and a fear aspect that's really there, that if I don't have my little domain and castle, then I am getting pretty close to that class of people then that are just renting, that are in the inner city and the ghettos, because that puts me too near that, and I'm fearful and afraid of that. And that's the whole thing with suburbia and getting in a car and driving everywhere. And going after the city of Portland, where I live, to get a bus to go through. The phenomenal bureaucracy I went through in many ultra meetings and going door to door to 300 people to get a bus to go through when we live in the city of Portland was unbelievable. And then I thought of the poor woman that has to go to 40 agencies for serious. I mean, I have a car. I can drive my kids there. But what is that telling them? So when I have to drive, now finally, because of a distance to a wonderful musician, because I have a gifted child musically, I now treasure that time. That time in the car with my son, 20 minutes either way now, is precious because of our lives.
Yeah.
And I'm not working full time, I'm part time, and I've chosen that and turned down jobs and all that. So those decisions are hard, but instead of looking at it as racing, now I see it as precious. Because maybe that'll be the time at age 13 he'll talk to me. And maybe it will.
just to highlight, I think a couple of very important things that were said here is that, again, this choice of time versus money takes very many forms. And one of the forms that it takes is this, do we need a bigger house where we live in? You know, my parents, again, made the choice that they were going to have this bigger new house. It was a much nicer house. But there was no sense of community, and in order to pay for that house, both of my parents then had to work full time, and I never saw them. So we really need to assess those kinds of decisions, I think, very practically. Go ahead and follow up, and then I'll come over here.
Linda, finish up and think back on your other topics. All the other topics that you mentioned, a number of them were issues that I can recall that we. I'll say we were dealing with on the first Earth Day back in 1970. I remember being part of breakfast programs in the communities. The political baggage was a bit steep sometimes, but a lot of these issues have been around a long time. And what you're talking about overall is basically an overall redistribution of wealth. Well, when you start throwing out buzzwords like that, they start to sound, and I'm going to continue to use buzzwords because these are ones everyone recognizes in the media, they're starting to sound a little pink. We won the Cold War. We beat them because we had the better system. And now we are able to continue to invest in our military so that we can go out and access the resources we need worldwide. And so within that overall context, you have to be very careful about talking about redistribution of wealth to a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I would agree with that, but I would just say that I think the redistribution of wealth is absolutely central to what I'm talking about. There are two differences for me. One is we're talking about that in the context of issues that many people in this society now feel strongly about. Something's not right. Their families aren't doing well. They're worried about their kids. They know that crime is a problem here. that there's all these things, and to be able to talk about that in a context, well, yeah, you're right, those are really bad things, what are we going to do with it? Then I think people have a little bit more of an openness to be talking about why it might be in their interest that we redistribute some wealth. And the second thing I think is really important, this is the balance I've tried to strike this week, and it's the balance we try to strike in our own life, is that this really, these problems that we're talking about really do have personal and social dimensions, that there is a frame of reference in which the personal choices we make can really be helpful to children. But there's also huge walls that come up there where we can make all the right personal choices and do all the right things, and we're still going to fail our children. So somehow we've got to find our way through that into that balance. One other thing that I just wanted to mention is a story that happens to me very frequently. I do probably most of the cooking, most of the shopping in our household, and I oftentimes take my kids with me when we go shopping. And supermarkets are very, very unfriendly places between parents and children, I think. And actually, my children and I do really, really well in that environment, probably for lots of different reasons. But one of the comments that I oftentimes get that I think is so revealing is that people will come up to me and say, babysitting, huh? And I think I used to just kind of smile, you're friendly. But what I started to say now, in a friendly way, but I said, no, actually, I'm parenting. And there, a lot of times they're kind of close. But I think that is so revealing in our society that men really aren't very expected to be very central to their children's lives. And I think that's very, very important that we are central to our children's lives.
I was just going to go on with that. We live in a community where most of the women don't work. And so they're home, and we have a nice community where all the kids are all playing out in the cul-de-sac and whatever. But we don't see the dads. And then my husband, I work part-time. He works a 40-hour week, but he's home to be out there and play with the kids. And many of the moms will come up to me and say, really admire him for being able to come home early from work and have time for the kids. And my point is, it's a choice we make. He's not working at a 70-hour job, and we don't take fancy vacations, and it's a personal choice. But he gets a lot of comments. He helps out in the school. Oh gee, you're so lucky your husband can help out in the school. Well, it's a choice, so I think having dads there is important.
Thank you very much. Make this comment, and then I think we need to bring this to a close. We'll both here, and then I want to just call your attention to a couple things on the board.
Okay. This is quick, but I was going to talk about how the neighborhoods can change. I live in a neighborhood, I think, similar to what you're describing, a suburb of Minneapolis, but very close to Minneapolis. And one of the disturbing things about this nice middle-class neighborhood that's occurring is because our yards are about a half an acre each. Across the street from us, someone bought a $140,000 house, knocked it down, and right across the street from our middle-class rambler, there is now a $459,000 house. And so my comment is, our neighborhood is worrying because there's four of them now occurring within a very brief period of time. So what we value as a nice, close, wonderful neighborhood, we're concerned very quickly will change.
Yeah.
I was just going to mention a comment that we need to be careful about blaming people for overworking them. I mean, I, for instance, and I know in Augustana, what we pay our secretarial staff, many families have to work 50, 60 hours a week to make ends meet. And I think we have to be careful blaming language, as if some people are making these choices when sometimes we just barely exist in a minimal sort of way they're working. So I think you have to be
sort of
careful
when you're advising. I mean, it's hard to nuance things in a short time, and I certainly talk about that. But where I end up on that is by saying we should not assume that all people have the choices that we have.
That's right.
And there's power in choosing. But we should hold ourselves accountable for the choices that we are able to make and not assume that everybody else has that choice and judge them through that lens. I think that's very important, very important.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
Can you give an example, in the world community of a government that operates on, let's say, a neo-social structure that's not homogenous, not one culture, one language, that really works.
You know, every time you quote France, you go to France now, you may not get on a bus.
That place stops.
England, my brother was just there, you couldn't get anywhere. The strikes are, you know, they are in a sense economically teetering right now. And
well, I've tried to say this word, you know, France and Sweden and all these countries that have had better social policies, they're all struggling with similar forces that we've talked about or touched on today. So there isn't... No,
I didn't mean to trap you with that. You're probably a lot more worldly than I am.
There isn't an ideal space. But I think what we can see from the European examples is that there are policy options that we could be pursuing that would be helpful, for one. And two, that they are going to be... we're going to be joining with them in confronting the reality of what globalization of the economy and whose interests that's being done. It's not going to just be us. There are lots and lots of growing numbers of people around the world that are starting to raise some pretty profound challenges about that. And no one knows exactly what's going to replace it, but I think it's very important that we recognize that those questions are happening. Just to bring this to a close, we'll pass time. I put up two names of two things here. If you have a copy of Family Values, you don't need this, it's listed in there. But there's a really neat initiative going on, Families Against Violence Advocacy Network. It's trying to get 1 million signatures of different, 1 million families to basically make a commitment to non-violence and looking at what that would mean in the context of families. And I only have one copy of it here. I was under the illusion that maybe they had a working Xerox machine here. But you could write them for this. And there's nothing too radical, but I think it's a really nice tool within a family to talk about some of these issues in some pretty practical ways. So I put that one up there. And then second, a lot of people come to Holden, myself included, are Lutheran. But so few people know about the Lutheran Office for Governmental Affairs. And you can write to them and get on their mailing list. And they have a wonderful legislative kind of updates that deal with some of the issues that we've touched on, you know, the welfare reform debate and other kinds of things. And then the last thing...
Jack, in addition to that, seeing they're part of the unit that I work out of too, we've worked on some working principles for welfare reform, very consistent with a lot of what you've been saying this week, that is regularly being used in the advocacy work with members of Congress around the welfare reform. So there's a number of
good. Yeah, I think this is a resource, and we have a resource here from within the church where we have some very good resources to help us with some of these issues. And the last thing I'll say is just so you know, I don't get a penny from this book. I've given all the royalties away. So if I keep hawking it, it's not because I want to make money. But the National Council of Churches, Friendship Press, which is the publisher of the book, they are doing they tell me by the end of this month. It's a study guide for congregational use of this book. So if you want to try to repeat something similar to what we did in these five sessions, they will have a study guide available. You can write to Friendship Press and order that from them. So, and you know, a book like this, the New York Times isn't going to talk about it. The only way it's going to get around is if people talk about it. So I hope some of you will find a way to use this to try to raise some of these issues.
Has it been distributed out to other publishers?
It literally came out. I got it about 2 weeks before we came to Holden. So I had a couple boxes of books shipped here. And so I'm not sure, but it should start appearing in bookstores, and I think what they were talking was to try to get Oxford Fortress and Cokesbury to be an outlet for the promoters of the book. I don't know if that's worth it or not.
Jack, it was reviewed in our paper in the area, in the paper that is distributed among most of the population. I read about
this book?
Yes.
How could it be out that fast?
You're already being reviewed.
Books, you know, whatever. It was definitely.
Could you send that to me? I would be interested.
I threw the whole thing away. I
didn't. There you go.
You recycle it, right?
Well, thank you very much. And some of you will.